Thank you very much, Dilma, for these kind words of introduction. Since Dilma did not give you my extensive bio, this is the visualization of my life story, my bio. Two things you may want to remember about me. I'm Swiss, but I lived up the street for 18 years in the great state of California. I'm an academic. I really believe and define myself as an academic, but yet I looped for industry for 14 years. Dilma mentioned VMware. I also then worked in hardware and networking, and actually I'm very happy to have one of my co-founders from Nuova Systems also in the room. This is a piece of work that ended up being part of Cisco's portfolio. For the past 5 years, I've been back in Switzerland, and I'm a faculty member at EPFL. So I structured my talk at sort of three levels of detail. Always important to start with the big picture. Then I will talk a little bit about the past, and in particular about virtualization, both the case study and how VMware happened, but also the history of virtualization. And then I'll talk about my current research. So let's start with the big picture. There are a few things that our community has had an impact on. One of them is obviously cloud computing, and cloud is obviously an established trend. It's no longer a debatable point. It has redefined the way we interact with computers, and it has redefined the set of opportunities. And it's nothing short of the industrial revolution of our own field. If you have any doubts about this, there are an infinite number of proof points. This is one of my classic ones, which is Amazon every day adds an absurd amount of capacity that was sufficient for Amazon itself a few years ago. Now, not only have we had an impact on very large cloud computing companies, we've also had an impact on the industry as a whole. IT used to be a function, and now IT is the core business for many things. As a matter of fact, Marc Andreessen probably coined it better than anybody else, software is eating the world, which basically means that every business is now about software. It is about how to extract value out of digital information. If you have any doubts about this, this is one of my favorite charts. It is basically shows on every row, you have 5 years apart, the five largest companies in the world by market cap, and you see that historically they were not software companies or high-tech companies. By 2016, every single one of the five largest companies is a high-tech company. The third impact that we've had is we've not only transformed as an industry, we've transformed the way people do business. We've transformed the way people interact with each other and the way they interact with, as a society, together with their governments. And the issues of privacy, security, and sovereignty have been completely redefined in the digital world. This is something that we are now at a point where leaders, administrative leaders, government leaders, legal scholars are trying to understand what this actually might mean. If you have any interest in that field, I believe this is actually an important aspect. I recommend that you follow Brad Smith's blog posts. I grew up in Geneva. Geneva is the home of the real Geneva Conventions, which is effectively a set of restraints that government have agreed to abide to protect civilians and prisoners of war. Brad Smith is proposing a digital equivalent, the Digital Geneva Conventions, which is also a set of restraints that are aimed at basically ensuring that governments actually limit their use of technology in order to protect the population. And then there's a fourth aspect of this big picture, which is there's another revolution that's happening. This one is actually just starting, which is the deep learning data science revolution. It's no longer about providing productivity tools or communication tools. It's about delivering insights that humans were previously unable to achieve. This is something we all need to internalize. Many of us are actually not super comfortable or familiar with these technologies, and yet it is a fundamental aspect and a fundamental disruption. It's actually happening faster than people imagine. Recently, The Economist had a cover on data being the new oil and being the most valuable resources. And that was the proof point on the right, which is a graph, which is the ImageNet challenge. For those of you who don't know, this is an academic challenge in image recognition. It's been out for about 20 years. And for 20 years, computers were not really good at it. And a 25% error rate is actually not particularly good. And in the last 5 years, what you've seen is computers going from the point of being not particularly good at solving the problem to actually being better than humans at solving that particular problem. OK. But at the end of the day, we're systems researchers. So these big trends may matter to the world, but how do they actually apply to us? And if you call, these are the four that I sort of listed. And in each and every one of us, I think there are some opportunities for us as a community. There's also things that we've done as a community that has had an impact. I think it's fair to say that when we look at cloud computing, that virtualization and distributed systems have had a foundational impact on cloud computing as it is organized today. And these are two very well-defined academic disciplines that were the originator of that innovation. Now, that this doesn't mean that this is the end. We can no longer do anything of interest or of value in cloud computing. If anything, there's an interesting trend, which is the large vendors are going through this phase of massive vertical integration. And we as systems researchers tend to focus on a very narrow slice of any particular problem, right? We have a workload, an IO subsystem, and an operating system, and we might change the workload to keep the other two unmodified, or we might change the IO subsystem. If you're Google, if you're Facebook, you're willing to change everything. And changing everything sometimes allows you to redefine the boundaries, eliminate boundaries, things that might seem to be necessary when in fact they're artifactual, and this is sometimes where you can deliver a lot of value. In the second category, again, as a community, we had a huge impact on analytics. All of the big data tools and techniques are things that were largely coming out of an academic community. These are largely open source tools. This is something that, again, we have done well. There are things that we have absolutely, totally, and completely ignored. If you look at the Internet of Things, right, this is probably one of the scariest things that you can that we can see today. There is no formal understanding of what it even means to be operating in those environments. And again, those should be viewed as research opportunity. In the third box, about security, sovereignty, and privacy, I'm not sure if we've done things well or not in the past. The point is the problem is not solved. It's about security, 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 and any breakthrough that actually allows us to reason differently about the privacy and the security of our systems will be extremely welcome. In addition, right, this is also the opportunity from a research perspective to try to solve new problems that kind of are grounded in real life and that basically can be explained to the people that we interact with in the society that we interact with outside of the pure tech circles. And then on the fourth box, you know, there's been a lot of impact and a lot of work and a lot of ongoing research on the return of specialization. Right? We lived for a while in an era where industry and hardware building blocks were largely commoditized components. And the rise of data science is actually changing the game, and now we're seeing the rise of highly specialized components. And this is something that is an opportunity for research, and again, also one that we've actually impacted. Now, as a systems person, there's still some fundamentally open problems in my mind, things that I think are not particularly well understood. And one of them is the question is, what is actually a system that is designed for machine learning or deep learning at its core? And by analogy, if I were to ask you the question, what is a system that is designed for transaction processing at its core, all of us have an intuition of what the question means and how to answer it, right? We know how to design a system, and we know what its attributes and characteristics might be, and we know how to compare these systems, two systems, according to well-defined metrics, because they're designed for transaction processing. The systems level metrics, the definition of the attributes, the properties, and the abstractions is not as properly understood, at least from my perspective, when it comes to these new fundamental building blocks, which are machines designed to do data science and interact with the real world. So four aspects and possibly four directions for potential research. Now I'm going to shift gears a little bit and focus on one of the technologies that was used in the first box, right? One of the foundations of cloud computing, which is virtualization, and give a little bit of going back in history, because the history of virtualization is actually worth understanding because it was very non-linear. It's also a history of a case of a transition, and my experience of taking technology from an academic work into something that had an impact on the real world. So because this was a transition from academia to entrepreneurship, it's actually helpful to put down first some basic fundamental tenets of what it means to actually start a company. And this is not an entrepreneurship lecture, but there are a few things that I picked up along the way that I consider to be truisms, or things that are always or nearly universally true if you're going to build a technology startup. And we'll see how it applies to VMware later. The first one, which people never like to hear, is that technology itself is only the necessary but not the sufficient condition for success, right? It's the prerequisite. And this is not true everywhere, right? This is true in tech. It's not true in biotech. If you have the right molecule and you have a clinical trial that proves that it's effective, you're done, right? There's no other issues. The science is enough. In our case, the science and the technology is not enough. And the reason why it's not enough is because you also need to have what people call a value proposition, which is the value to user. And the value proposition has to be, at the same time, simultaneously relevant, simple to communicate, and defensible. And it's sometimes easy to have a value proposition that is relevant but impossible to communicate or impossible to defend. Sometimes you have a value proposition that is impossible to defend but easy to communicate. Having and scoring well on all three axes is actually important, if not essential, for success. There are a few more. One is it's important to always look forward, because at the end of the day, when you build something, that is the only direction that matters. Where you came from, what you did in the past is irrelevant. Timing is everything. Sometimes things are too early. There is no market. We innovate a lot. We try to be at the very leading edge, and sometimes that's great. We need to do this. This is how science makes progress. But then any kind of venture, commercial venture, might be years away. And then at the end of the day, we don't have to talk about it. It's going to be more expensive than you think. Okay, so let's apply this to virtualization. First, we need to make sure we all understand what virtual machines are. This is a slide I use in my own undergraduate lectures, right? And presumably, many of you who are teaching operating system classes might use a variant of that slide in your lectures, right? This is how we explain to an undergraduate what a VM is. It's the abstraction of a computer system. It runs on top of a VMM or hypervisor. And then the VM has these three fundamental attributes, right? Equivalence, safety, and performance, right? You need to have all three in order to claim that you actually are virtualizing the system. This is taught today because it's important and relevant. This is obviously not groundbreaking, right? This comes from a paper in 1974. Right, so the Popek and Goldberg paper put down the fundamental principles that define what a virtual machine is. It formalizes also the requirements for virtualization. And that paper had one interesting theorem, right? Many interesting things, but one of the most important aspects of that paper is its first theorem, which basically says that, and I'm going to paraphrase it, if you can take an instruction set architecture and you can characterize the instructions so that the ones that are sensitive are also privileged, then you can build a VMM. So what is a privileged instruction? We all know. What is a sensitive instruction? It is an instruction whose semantic varies only can vary because of the privilege level or because of the system environment or because of the location of certain addresses being used. All right? And if those sensitive instructions are privileged, then you win, and you can build a VMM. Not particularly hard, right? It's actually a fundamental theorem. It's one of the few theorems we have in our field. And the proof, which is interesting, is a proof by construction. And this is actually what the construction generally looks like. You need to have a computer. That computer needs to have one bit, which allows you to separate user mode from kernel mode. And you need to have a trap architecture to go between the two. And then you need to have some form of virtual memory. Segmentation might be fine. Paging might be fine. If you don't have that, either of those two prerequisites, you can't build a VMM. Now, that's not particularly hard. And then this is obviously the catch. You can't screw up the instruction set architecture, and you can't screw up virtual memory. And if you don't screw up both of them, then you can actually sketch out the VMM. And with the sketch, you can actually formally prove that you can actually build the VMM. And the details, for those of you who are interested, are actually in the paper. Okay? Not my paper, their paper. Okay? So we can view, in a way, right, virtualization and the Popek and Goldberg theorem as one of the great contributions of 1974. Right? Now, there were other great substantial contributions in 1974, and one of them is ABBA won the Eurovision contest that year. Right? So this was disco, was all over the map, had a big impact, had a worldwide impact, all the way to Europe. Now, with every great contribution comes a great correction. And on this day, in 1979, baseball fans went to a baseball stadium and actually voluntarily donated their LPs so that they could be burned, in the diamond or somewhere, right, on the field. Right? So this was a great contribution that did not last very long. So enough about music. Let's go back to systems. This paper occurred at an era where virtual machines were becoming mainstream in mainframes. Right? This was not an esoteric side project. This was the formalization by academics of something that had a big impact in industry, because there were many industrial systems that had been built. And the reason and the motivation for that paper was that DEC had just introduced a new computer architecture, which was the PDP-10. And the PDP-10 actually screwed up the instruction set architecture. There's at least one or two instructions that were screwed up. And because they're screwed up, you can't build a VMM, and they wrote a paper about it. Right? And that is the foundational motivation for the paper. Now, unfortunately, the rest of the industry either did not read the paper, did not understand the paper, or did not care about the paper, because the MIPS architecture screwed up virtual memory. The x86, the 386 architecture screwed up virtualization, even though they introduced a mode, which is called V8086, to virtualize 16-bit 8086 mode. But the 386 itself was not virtualizable. Intel had plenty of opportunities to fix this. The Pentium didn't change a thing. ARM came along and also had its own issues that led to the non-virtualizability of the architecture. In short, nobody cared. Right? And Dilba mentioned the DISCO paper. The DISCO paper was published 20 years ago at SOSP. And if you actually look at the second sentence of the paper, which I will read here, right? Actually, which was she here? Which is we? Well, I can't read it from here, right? And I can't read it from here either. It basically said, well, we bring back an old idea from the 1970s, which is virtual machine monitoring. And that's also the reason why we actually called DISCO DISCO. So now you know.
No.
Right? Huh? It's not an acronym. It's not. It's just a bad idea from the 1970s. Okay. So this was DISCO, right? This was actually a slide. Slightly updated graphically, but fundamentally a slide from the DISCO talk 20 years ago. It was a highly scalable virtual machine monitor at a time when operating systems did not scale. And virtual machines were creating a cluster on top of the shared memory architecture. And there were a lot of really interesting academic challenges. One of them was, how do you create something that actually has the same performance as a single system image, even though you're running a cluster of operating systems that must communicate with each other? So it was really about communication protocols. It was about sharing and sharing resources transparently and efficiently. And we had to do that with mostly unmodified operating systems. Now, if you recall, the MIPS architecture was not virtualizable, so we had to modify the OS anyway. And so we made the necessary modifications, and which means we sort of did a workaround to the scripts of virtual memory. And then we actually did a few additional modifications whose aim was to actually improve performance. So classic and total academic treatment of a problem. You bring back an old idea, you sort of frame it in a particular way, and you get your paper published. So the paper actually had an impact. And so the obvious question was what to do about it and if to do something about it. And this was the first internet bubble. And so we were looking at different options. And the obvious option would have been to do that same version, but a commercial variant of it for SGI, which at the time had large-scale MIPS multiprocessors. We didn't really think about that one too long. A more interesting angle that we actually studied was, at the time, DEC had some really cool 64-bit RISC processors. Was the Alpha CPU. They had the TurboLaser machines, which were scalable machines, and they had an explicit strategy to support three operating systems, which were VMX, Ultrix, and Windows, because at the time, Windows ran on alphas. There was this phenomenal opportunity to actually create a system that would allow those three operating systems, part of the strategy, to run simultaneously on the same machine, as opposed to being mutually exclusive from each other. And then, obviously, we went to where the market really was, and where the market really was at the time was already the x86 architecture. Windows was dominating on desktops. Linux was starting to dominate on servers, was growing largely on servers, and we saw that as an opportunity, and this is sort of where VMware came around, right? So if you tie this back to some of the truism about business that I mentioned, it was a clear case of always looking forward, right? We did not use a single line of code from the DISCO work into VMware. It was not relevant, nor would it have been the right decision. It is also about having a value proposition. So the relevance was clear on desktops, because at the time, people had multiple desktops below their desks, and they were constantly reimaging systems because of having to deal with different variants of different operating systems. It was also relevant on servers because of server consolidation, because servers were completely underutilized at the time. The value proposition was simple to communicate, because even though nobody at the time remembered what a virtual machine was, You explained virtual machine and people were absolutely convinced that we had invented a brand new concept. But the concept was relatively simple that you could actually explain it in 30 seconds. And last but not least, it was defensible. And it was in particular defensible from a technology perspective. And the reason it was defensible from a technology perspective is that it actually leverages the lesser known third theorem of Popek and Goldberg. And that theorem, which is a little bit harder to read, it basically says, if your architecture is screwed up and you cannot build a VMM, but it's not that screwed up so that you can still use direct execution, which is the technique used to, that the VMM used to run efficiently, you can still use direct execution for user, for applications, for user mode, then you can still rely on some fallback mechanism, which is to emulate the kernel, right, or interpret the kernel. Right? And that basically is what the theorem basically says. If you only screw up virtualization, the architecture from a virtualizability when it applies to user mode, you can still have some kind of a solution. And that is basically the solution that we actually did with VMware. VMware basically is a combination of two different execution engines. The first one is the direct execution engines that is typical of virtual machine monitors. And the other execution engine is a dynamic binary translator, which takes x86 code and converts it into sandbox x86 code. And we use that to run significant parts of the system. How do we determine the boundary? This is actually one of the most subtle aspects of VMware. It's basically a combination of conditions. If you're running in kernel mode or anything other than user mode, you have to use the binary translator. If you're, for some reason, you're running in user level, but you can disable interrupts, which you can on the x86, and which some people do, then you have to use binary translation. If you're using some backward compatibility mode, one of the legacy modes, then you have to use binary translation. And then the x86 architecture has this unique feature, which is that segments are semantically non-reversible. And on top of that, Windows and some versions of Windows leverage that capability. And if you're in that particular mode, then you obviously are stuck using dynamic binary translation, even though you could otherwise go back to user mode. And there are a few corner cases. And by my memory is weak by now, but like the install of Win95, which leverages Windows 3, actually had some of those characteristics. Right, so it was a little bit subtle, but at the same time, the answer was sound in the sense that there was a single decision algorithm that at any point in time, independent of the independent of any assumption about the instruction stream, allow us to determine whether binary translation was necessary or whether direct execution was possible. And if you look at those three attributes from Popek and Goldberg, we did pretty well when it comes to equivalence. If you really look at the details of corner cases of instructions, there are a few that were not completely well handled, or actually that were not correctly handled, and they cannot be correctly handled, but in practice, they didn't have an impact. Performance was an interesting story at the time because, and the young people in the room don't remember, but we used to have Moore's Law. And when you have Moore's Law, right, you have this phenomenal marketing answer, which is we give you the performance of the computer from a generation before. And that was phenomenal, right? Because half of the computers were already from the generation before. So you'd say, you know, if it wasn't fast enough, I'm just going to buy a new computer and my VM will run at least as fast as my real machine from the previous computer. And we never compromised on safety. Two important additional attributes, and those were not discussed in the 70s. They ended up playing an important role, is that VMware had an encapsulation property and has an encapsulation property still today. And that basically means that you can take the entire state of a virtual machine and you can checkpoint it, and you can do that at rest, you can do that for a running virtual machine. This is what VMware calls vMotion, what academically we call live migration. And the other attribute is that the virtual machine is hardware independent. The device drivers effectively don't make their way into the virtual machine. And that means you can actually push your image into Amazon and you never really know what Amazon actually has, and it doesn't matter because it's virtualized anyway. And these new attributes, both of them would actually end up playing a substantial impact on the adoption of virtualization as one of the foundations for the cloud. So where are we today? Well, it's used for scalable multi-tenancy. If anything, it's the only solution known that actually delivers multi-tenancy at scale without restriction. Is the use of virtual machines. And this is commonly associated with simply cloud. It's also used to consolidate servers, to consolidate storage. It's used to distribute appliances. It's not the best way, by the way. Containers are a much better way to distribute content than virtual machine images, but virtual machine images were used at the time, and these two could be used in combination. It solves availability problems. It solves a cluster management problem. Carl Walsberg is in the room. Build the system at VMware that allows a collection of servers to be used as one from a pooling perspective and automatically rebalances the load. And now virtualization as a technology is used to virtualize networks and deploy everything on super simple, ultra-converged hardware building blocks. A lot of other things have changed. The description I gave you of VMware Workstation and the virtualization engine was obviously that of 1999. It's not the description of the virtualization engine of today, and that is because the architectures have now introduced virtualization again. It's available in the CPU. Intel's called it VTX. ARM calls it ARMv. In the MMU, in the interrupts, in the I/O bus, where we can now virtualize physical addresses on the I/O bus. We can virtualize I/O devices into multiple I/O devices. And then we obviously virtualize network traffic through overlays. At the same time, and this is a little bit of the cautionary tale, we tend to go backwards at the same time as we go forward. Right? To my chagrin, the transition from 32-bit, which was not virtualized, to 64-bit, which had virtualization support, also removed segments. Now, segments were really close to my heart because they were necessary for binary translation, so we used them a lot. But segments actually are more broadly applicable and were broadly used. There are cases where you use segments to do application sandboxing in a very efficient way. And the lack of segmentation means that there are some technologies and sandboxing solutions that were proposed for 32-bit, including the Google Native Client, which were never carried, cannot be carried over to a 64-bit architecture. And that's a little bit of a shame. And then more recently, Intel introduced SGX, and I've been asking around, okay, so we have SGX, we have VTX, how did these two things work together? And obviously, they're designed for a different purpose. SGX is designed to run an enclave, right? VTX is designed to run a virtual machine, so what if I wanted to run my virtual machine as an enclave? Well, it wasn't designed for this. And so we now have this intersection where effectively you have to choose your technologies, which is a little bit unfortunate. And so my caution in this is that history might repeat itself because industry develops, academia formalizes, and then industry chooses to forget. Now, enough about industry. I've been back in academia for the last few years, and I want to share some thoughts that we glean in studying low latency problems and latency sensitive problems. And I don't want to repeat sort of all my paper results, but I want to effectively highlight some important themes, and particularly about trade-offs that we see in systems. So the motivation of the problem space that we decided to look at were some of the infrastructure issues of the very large-scale cloud providers, which actually don't use virtualization as their foundational infrastructure, because they do not have a multi-tenancy problem. It's well understood that energy proportionality was and is a problem. Tail tolerance is also an open problem when you have an application with high fan-out and high fan-in rates, and you need to operate and provide responses time in interactive timescales. And then most recently, there was a paper that was interesting that was actually talking about the unstudied or understudied timescale, which is that of microsecond-scale computing. We know well how to solve problems in hardware at nanosecond scales. We know well how to solve problems in operating systems at millisecond scales by scheduling resources, and we're really at a loss when it comes to solving problems and system-level problems where the individual operation costs a few microseconds. So I don't know if they're the world's biggest problems. I don't know if they're Google's biggest problems. There's a chance they are actually Luis Barroso's top-of-mind problems because he's the common denominator behind these three papers. So I'm going to share some results from a project that we have. This is a project that started as a collaboration between EPFL and Stanford with Adam Belay, who's now a faculty member at MIT. I'm going to go very briefly on the data plane aspect, which was published at OSDI. It was also presented at USENIX as part of the Best of the Rest in 2015. And then I'll give some results from the control plane paper, which was published at SOCC. So just the main contributions of the work, it's really to provide an architecture that uses virtualization hardware to deliver protection from application in the context of a data plane, where basically a data plane is an alternative to using the operating system to doing I/O by effectively running things in a busy loop. And X has an execution model for both that is designed to increase throughput and at the same time provided and lower latency, in particular lower tail latency. How do we do this? Well, we separate control and data, as we've been doing in the networking industry for decades, as we're doing more and more in the systems from a systems perspective. The data plane is very simple. It just runs in a loop. The control plane is responsible to allocate resources. The system setup is done using a framework called Dune, which exposes the IX operating system as a privilege process that can actually access and issue privilege instructions running in virtualized hardware mode. And then IX itself runs the application on top. The data plane has sort of three basic design points. One is it runs packets to completion. This is not unique. Most data planes have this property. There's only one place where we buffer. We buffer things that we have not yet processed. Once we start processing, we process it to the end. By doing this, we actually can improve the data cache locality because packets stay in the cache. And we can, more importantly, eliminate scheduling unpredictabilities because there's only one place where things are buffered. There's only one scheduling discipline, which is first come, first serve, so you have less flexibility, but also less unpredictability. To increase throughput, we actually have a scheme in which we can batch packets if there are multiple packets that are pending, rather than going through the loop one at a time. This actually improves iCache locality because you can run things more efficiently because you run the same piece of code over multiple packets in a small loop. You can use prefetching. There's a place where we actually use prefetching in a super interesting way. And then you can do that while bounding the impact on latency because the batch itself is bounded in size. And we use that effectively. And there's basically a 30% boost for some micro benchmarks by using this technique. And then the third one is we rely on the hardware to separate traffic so that we can operate in parallel. So this is designed for multi-core by design. We use the NIC hardware to separate traffic into flows, and the flows go into flow groups. The flow groups are dynamically mapped into queues, and the queues are mapped one-to-one to cores. And if you do this in this particular way, and if you follow my logic, then basically each core then operates on a partition subset of the flow groups, which means that the data structures don't need to have locks. And so you can effectively run an entire TCP stack without any locks. Now, that's only good enough for the TCP stack. If you actually run the whole thing without locks, you actually need to have a commutative API. That is the result from Austin Clements. You need to follow the scalable commutativity rule. POSIX does not follow that rule, so we just broke POSIX. Right? You have to make choices and trade-offs. So I gave some of the design points and the starting point. What's important about this so far is that IX leverages and makes a number of very sweeping simplifications, which I've always presented as a virtue, right? We simplify, we eliminate scheduling unpredictably by having a very predictable but also ultra-simplistic schedule, for example. And this is something that we commonly do in systems and something that we should be doing in systems. So one really classic canonical example is an in-memory database is not a database that actually stores the data in memory. An in-memory database leverages multiple sweeping simplifications to have a completely different architecture than a traditional database. So you make the sweeping simplifications, you apply them to the max, and you can actually get some substantial benefits. But there is often a trade-off. Obviously, the explicit trade-off of the in-memory database is that it's non-persistent. Sometimes the trade-offs are more hidden. And I'm going to talk about two trade-offs, the first one in some detail, the second one more superficially. And the first trade-off is that the polling model that these data planes, and this is not unique to IX, have, limits or can limit system efficiency. And the way we studied this is we picked a workload and we picked a service level objective. And it's important when you look at cloud scale workloads to not really care about saturation with unbounded latency and response times because that's not relevant. You want to have a service level objective. And the service level objective here is measured in at the 99th percentile and it's basically capped at 500 microseconds. Right? So 500 microseconds, half a millisecond, is the budget that we have to respond to 99% of requests as measured by the client on the client side. Right? And what you basically see is not completely unanticipated, according to queuing theory. Right? As you increase the throughput, the latency and the tail latency shoots up, and eventually you cross the line. And that is basically what we determine as the saturation point for that particular workload. And in the case of Memcache, we were able to demonstrate a roughly 6x performance increase. Right? Now, there's another metric that you can also choose to apply, and that metric is the x-axis is the same, it's still the load, but rather than measuring the tail latency, you just measure the amount of power drawn, and we use the Intel RAPL counters, and you measure the amount of power drawn as long as you're not violating the service level objective, right? Beyond the violation, then there are no data points. All the data points assume you're below the cutoff. And this is the curve for Linux with the maximum configuration of the system. And what you actually see, it's not completely energy proportional, but it's pretty good, right? And, you know, it's some kind of a slope, right? And if you draw a lot, if there's a lot less requests, you will draw a lot less energy. And at saturation, you will draw, you know, 85 watts, right? If you compare X, you actually have something like this, right? So the line is nearly flat, which is not good, right? That's the opposite of energy proportional. It's energy flat, I guess, or nearly flat. And what you basically see is there's an apparent trade-off, right? Beyond a certain level of load, using X as your system foundation might make sense, and below a certain level of load, using Linux might make more sense. Obviously, shifting between the two is neither ideal nor practical. But the one thing I want to emphasize is this is an apples-to-apples comparison of the maximum system configuration. There are many ways in which we can configure a system. As a matter of fact, there are 224 ways in which you can configure a system if you're willing to vary the number of cores used, whether hyperthreading is used or not, and the clock rate of the socket. And whenever you have a situation where you can make resource allocation decisions, you can reduce it to an economics principle, which is the Pareto frontier. And the Pareto frontier is a synthetic curve, which is achieved by determining for any particular load. By the way, those taking pictures, you can get the slides, right? For every particular level of load, the goal is to actually have to identify the static configuration that will give you the best possible outcome, in our case, the lowest possible amount of energy while meeting the objectives. And so the Pareto frontiers are synthetically constructed in this particular way. And what we basically see is the opposite effect, is that if you actually consider the Pareto frontier, and let's say your load is always a constant, then there's always a configuration where the data plane is better than the general purpose operating system. Of course, obviously, the problem is that the load is never a constant, right? And so the challenge is to actually build a system that actually dynamically adapts. And the opportunity is substantial because there's a 50% reduction in energy if you're willing, if you have a way to adjust your resource as well. And so how do we do this? Well, the control plane implements the policy, and particularly it implements the control loop. And then the system implements the various mechanisms, and one of them is the adjustment of the clock rate. This is for illustration purposes. We found out three key challenges in this work. The first one, which I'll go back to, is the order in which you add resources. The second one is very basic control system theory, right? Nothing magic. You need to have a control loop. It needs to be stable. It needs to have a hysteresis. And you need to identify how to basically implement it. But once you have it, there's nothing particularly deep. And then there's a really cute systems problem, which is this actually works by reconfiguring the NIC dynamically. And you have to do that without blocking traffic because there's no way you can block traffic. So there's this inherent race condition between the traffic they receive according to one particular configuration of the NIC and the fact that at one point that configuration will change and then traffic will go to another core and the details are in the paper. But I want to go back to the Pareto analysis because the Pareto analysis actually drives the policy decision as to what is the next resource to add. So it's clear and it's intuitive that you start with an approach in which you have the least amount of resources at the lowest load, right? One core, no hyperthreading, the lowest clock rate. That's somewhat intuitive. The question is, what do you do next? And the answer, and your mileage will vary and may vary, right? But the answer for Memcache, which is an application that scales well, and for the Sandy Bridge CPUs, which is the one we had, is, and is not intuitive, that the first order of business is to add cores. Right, so you go from one core to eight cores. Once you run out of cores, then you use the second hyperthread on each core in that order. Right? So then you enable hyperthreading. And only once you've run out of hardware threads do you ever consider increasing the clock rate. Now, this is not intuitive because nearly all of our systems run at the maximum clock rate. Right? We may not enable turbo boost, but we typically run at the nominal clock rate. If actually you have a service level objective, and you can monitor whether you're in violation or not of your service level objective, you can and should probably start with the lowest possible clock rate and only increase it as a last resort. And this is a general statement, right? You can apply this methodology to any system, hardware, at any workload. And then only use Turbo Boost as the last resort, and maybe your company makes a policy decision to never allow it because it's actually grossly inefficient from an energy perspective, even though it does increase your throughput range. And this is sort of our evaluation of this. And so this was, we have different patterns in the paper. This is a 4-minute cycle where the load goes up, load goes down, right? We have a load generator that actually sort of changes the load and the arrival rate of the different requests. And what you see here are, there's one type of triangle that adds a core, the other one that increased the clock rate, and on the way down, we obviously applied in the other dimension. We measured the service, the tail latency, right? Because at the end of the day, the objective is to never violate the service level objective. And we do see some violations, right? And the reason why you have violations is because it's an intrinsically a consequence of the fact that this is a control plane approach. The data plane operates at a microsecond scale. The control plane updates counters and statistics every 10 milliseconds and makes a policy decision every 100 milliseconds, which then needs to propagate, and some of these propagation take time. And so you end up having something that is a control plane level interaction. And so we have violations, and sometimes in that step pattern, this is our worst pattern, and these violations don't last more than a second, which we believe to be acceptable, right? So we do have violations. This is not hard real time. This is soft real time, but we minimize the violations. And this is sort of the result. The takeaway is the same graph on the top, and then below what you actually have is the three different curves. The red curve is synthetic. This is the Pareto synthetic curve. The purple curve is the max static configuration, the one you should not be using by default, that most of us always do. And in black is the curve that we actually have in our system. So, and if you actually look at the details, we're within 7 watts of the optimal. So this was the first trade-off. I want to just super briefly talk about the second trade-off that we're starting to study, and this is basically the importance of time scales as we look at applications beyond ultra-simple RPCs. And Memcache is a phenomenal workload, by the way, guys, right? I mean, I don't know how many papers have used Memcache as a workload. We have. No shame, right? And this is a hash table, right? The world is slightly more complex than simply having a hash table with no semantics, right? And so we start to study how do we, you know, effectively determine whether X is good for anything other than Memcache, right? I mean, that is, in a way, is the question we kind of ask ourselves. And rather than looking at different workloads, right, because it's difficult to pick workloads, right, we said, what if we just ignore workload for a second, right? And rather than using workloads, actually just use a synthetic model, right? Because you can actually take a synthetic model, and you can actually implement a synthetic model on a real system. That is nothing more than an application that just spins for a while and returns, right? That basically is your system's implementation of that synthetic model. And this is, synthetic model is ultra simple, right? It's just a queuing server. It's an RPC server. There's an arrival rate. There's a service rate. There's a service time. And one of the nice things about having a synthetic model is you can express your service level objective in a time scale independent way. Is this the best way to express it? I don't know, but at least it's time scale independent. So here I picked a service level objective, which is I want 99% of my requests to come back to the client within 10x the mean service time, right? My mean service time is 5 microseconds, 99% need to come back within 50, right? But I have a time scale independent service level objective. Now, because everything is time scale independent, I can actually run this and do different comparison. You can have the load that is time scale independent and the latency that is time scale independent. I can figure out the closed form solution if I'm good enough in math and if there is one, or I can actually use a discrete event simulation and I can actually create a model that is time scale independent. And then I can actually do the opposite, which is I can take my system, in my case, my operating system, or somebody else's operating system, right? And then I can run my synthetic application on top, and then I can normalize my result back to the time scale independent model. And I have an apples to apples comparison. And that is what we did, right? So we just varied the time scale. And this is sort of the result, and it's the only result I'll show. So what you have here on the x-axis is the time scale, which is the mean service time in microseconds, and this is I can't see, I think this should be about 100, right? So this is roughly 100 microseconds, right? And what you have on the y-axis is the load, and the load is as a percentage of saturation. Now, what Markov told us 100 or 200 years ago, right, is that you can never get to saturation. If you actually have a particular model, and my model is an MD1 model, so it's a Poisson arrival time, it's a deterministic service time, and there is one queue per server, which means it's the shared nothing synchronization three model, then I can get, you know, between, you know, close to 75% of the saturation before I violate my service level objective. The horizontal line is the time scale independent saturation point as predicted by the model. And by definition, everybody else will be below. And what you basically see, and there's a first observation, which is Memcache is really conveniently at the super left side of the spectrum, right, where I can show a 6x gain. Once my time scale becomes a little bit bigger, and which means that my mean granularity of a task is a little bit bigger, then obviously the gains become less important. There is, however, as we've studied a broader set of workloads, there's a large number of workloads that are relevant and very important that are RPC-driven, that participate in these large high fan-in, high fan-out computation, that actually have time scale in the 1 to 50 microsecond range. So this is the range that actually matters. And then we see, obviously, that X, which is the blue line, converges to the saturation point as predicted by theory, which is also good. It's actually good to get your graduate students to pose the problem, apply the scientific method, a priori establish what the upper bound should be, and then measure it, and then they'll immediately, you know, obviously the first version of that graph, which you did not see, actually had a result that was actually better than the upper bound, and then this is how you find out bugs. Right? And for those of you who actually are interested in the details, and again, this goes back to the sweeping simplification, Linux has many options, right? You can use Linux in 18 different ways. This is Linux using EPOL and partition connections, which is something that can be approximated by the MD1 model. It's not the only way in which you can schedule resources, and you can obviously steal tasks in some cases. And so time scale matter and granular matters. So this is the conclusion, the end of my talk. In the first part, I identify four problems. Let's make sure we never forget the big picture. But let's also view that these are opportunities for new directions in system research. I gave a little bit of a history lesson on the case study of virtualization. And to me, the two big themes, right? The first one is industry develops, because that is their job. Academia formalizes, because that is our job, right? Sometimes industry builds on top of what we do. But what we fundamentally do is we formalize things that exist. And then industry forgets, because it's also their job to forget and to make the appropriate business decisions. And so we have this cycle, and it's important to actually make sure that we can make sure that the cycle doesn't get out of whack too much. Technology is a prereq. And then in the last one, hopefully your takeaway is time scales model matter. And then models matter and bounds matter. And the notion of having a Pareto comparison is helpful for scientific research. The notion of having upper bound for saturation point is also helpful as you do systems research. And I want to thank you for your attention. I also want to thank all my collaborators at EPFL, the ones at Stanford, and then the one at MIT who have contributed to this work. Thank you very much. And I guess Dilma will.
Yeah, we have time for questions. Come to the microphones. Don't forget to introduce your name and your institution so that, in particular, the students will know how to address you with this URL.
Andy.
Andy Tannenbaum for University of Tennessee. I've been around for a long time. And we've gone through the cycle of centralized, decentralized, and so on quite a few times. When I started, we had big mainframes like Multics that had many users, but sometimes you couldn't get any work done because somebody else was hogging all the resources. So we went to personal computers, and now we're back to centralized with the cloud. I mean, what happens? I mean, are we going to get in a situation where some poor grad student is trying to get his or her paper ready for using ATC 2018, and just when they're getting to work, Walmart decides to have a special and dynamically allocates 100,000 machines and takes up the whole cloud, and they can't get any work done? And are we going to go back to decentralized again after a while for the same reason we went to decentralized the first time?
So I guess that's a great question, right? But I think there are different answers, right? I think, first of all, the answer about Walmart and Amazon, first of all, if Amazon runs out of steam, you can always go to Google, right? That would be Google's answer to the problem.
Not so easily, and not dynamically, the deadline tomorrow.
But there's another thing, which is the law of large numbers does make things somewhat predictable, and the fact that there is a monetary constraint means that the system is stable, right? So is the cloud stable fundamentally in perpetuity, I don't know, is has it been stable over the last 10 years? Yes, because capacity has always been ahead of demand. Now, and that's certainly been historically fact. It's the same question, so is the financial system intrinsically stable or not? I don't know, right? It's worked well or not super well over the last 200 years, and it will go through pain points. So the pain points will happen. It doesn't invalidate the trend. I think the trend is now becoming somewhat irreversible, and the reason for this is the local area network used to matter. And quite frankly, the local area network doesn't matter anymore. And as a matter of fact, the last thing I want from at home is a local area network that does anything than simply tunnel all the traffic up and make sure that my devices at home never communicate with each other, because why would I trust them anything any more than anybody else? And so I think we're in this phase where we've moved from sort of this assumption of distributed computing between desktops and endpoints, and we're now in this point where we have distributed computing, but rather than being distributed close to us, it's distributed in the cloud. Irfan.
Hey, Irfan Ahmed, Cache Physics.
I don't know everyone here, but we should, somebody that I don't know should also ask a question.
So I read the X project work with a lot of interest. And latency obviously matters a lot at the systems level, but it seems like there may be a divergence here. So we talk about cloud as perhaps an irreversible trend for the foreseeable future. And each one of the large cloud providers, we're still looking at on the order of 100 places in the world, that's still very large latency. So there's this gap of what X is trying to accomplish and lots of other interesting things that are happening which are down at that scale, with perhaps the reality of your memcache sitting inside a data center being super fast, right? More power to X. But the user is so far away. The relevance of, so how do you view the various timescales and therefore the relevance of the progress in each of those domains, and in particular with X in mind?
All right, so this is a great question. So I think we should, and maybe I'll answer a variant of it. So intuitively, I think for all of us, there's at least two dimensions, right? There is communication to the cloud, and then there's communication, or to the data center, and then there's within the data center. In the first, the former, the speed of light dominates, and the latter, the speed of light is largely irrelevant. And if anything, that's the issue of chasing these kilomicroseconds, which is speed of light is no longer the bound. There is no bound other than engineering issues being layered on top of each other, right? And if you read the paper on those kilomicroseconds, that's the argument. And so I think one of the key questions from a systems perspective is how many units of scope do we actually need to think about? What are the building blocks? Clearly, the data center is a building block, and because access to the data center is infinitely slower, right? And so we need to minimize communication between data centers for online purposes, right? And that's why, that's effectively how the cloud is organized today. There's very little cross communication between cloud and data centers. People reduce the number of RPCs to the minimum. Then the question is there a granularity within the data center? Right? And if you actually look at the design points, they have these notion of availability zones, which are basically effectively aggregates next to each other within the same building. But these are very large constructs. And I think there is an open question, which is there a construct even below that in which we use architecturally distinct principles? And this is one of my other research topic, which is in rack scale memory systems, where does it actually make sense to build a system that has maybe the scale of a rack? It has a limited scale, but it is more than a single computer, a lot more than a single computer, and you actually design a dedicated set of interconnects and programming models and architectures that actually take advantage of the latencies at that granularity. And there's an open question as to whether there's two or three of those scopes as you build out your systems.
Dave Todd, just two comments. People like Van Jacobson and myself get very twitchy when you start talking about network traffic, latency, and Pareto distributions. He has a wonderful old rant. It's called a Q rant from 2006. It's well worth reading for a different opinion. Similarly, all this stuff in the cloud still means that you have to consider tens or hundreds of microseconds or milliseconds as acceptable, whereas if more and more work were done on the homeland, we'd be down to where we would always be able to reduce latencies below the perceptible.
So two very good points. The first one, I think I know the debate you're referring to. So the Pareto, to be very clear, right, what we basically use, we use a Pareto methodology as a way to economically drive a control plane making resource allocation in the system domain. Right? This has zero impact on the latency domain. We're not twiddling with any of the TCP parameters. Right? This is purely a system resource allocation that is used to apply, and that is used to control resource. Now, is this the right way to think about the problem, the wrong way to think about the problem? It's certainly not the only way to think about the problem, but it is a different way than the use of Pareto in the networking domain. Right? So it's economically not the same argument. The second point you're making is, yeah, I mean, is can we do things in, you know, we'll never fix the speed of light, obviously, and so there are things that must be done locally, and there are things in which, and there are applications where local computation is essential. You know, autonomous vehicles hopefully will not depend on the cloud for their steering and for their control loops, right? That's a classic example, cyber-physical systems. There's a lot of things that have to do with the interaction between humans and systems in the cyber-physical world, which have to be done locally. What you will have is you will have effectively a local data plane. What we will always have is, because it seems irreversible, is the control and the management domains will be in the cloud. So all the issues of security, privacy will end up being back into the cloud, because the management domain plane and the control plane, if there is one, will be done from the cloud, even though you may have local interactions that are done locally to take advantage of efficiency.
We'll take only one more question on that side, please.
Oh, great. Hi, Ed. Bob Lance, MiniNet Project. So I thought your insight of that, you know, sort of control data plane separation is maybe more widely applicable to things beyond software-defined networking and also to operating systems and rest of systems is really interesting. But my question actually is sort of about the title of your talk. I mean, you talk about sort of like supposedly computer systems research and the post-virtualization era. I guess, you know, question number one, are we in post-virtualization that, you know, virtualization is over, it's a solved problem, or maybe we don't care about virtualization, we're doing like bare metal provisioning, which is actually pretty cool, or hardware virtualization rather than software virtualization, or maybe partitioning, which are all kind of neat things. You know, and also, does it really change system research? It looks like it's kind of the same thing since, you know, 1974, right?
So I have two answers. One is the honest answer, and then the other one I'll just make up right now, right? So the honest answer is when they ask you to submit the abstract and your title a month in advance, right? And I'm holding a few jobs right now, so I came up with the best title I thought at the time, and then at one point you have to actually do the slides for the keynote, and you do the work, and by that point you're committed to a title, but you actually hope you can get away with an evolution from the title. So if I had to pick a title today, it might be a different title. So that's my honest answer. Now, I think your question is really important. I mentioned in the context of containers, right? VMs are not the best way to deploy software, right? Obviously, right? Containers are better, and containers are not the best
containers
way.
Containers are still terrible, I just want
to
say.
And containers are not the best way to deploy software, right? Because we need a way to deploy software that is a testable,
shared
secure, reproducible, and so forth, right? When people talk about bare metal virtual machines, again, I think most of us know what this means. Most of us know that this has nothing to do with the Popek and Goldberg principles, right? But fundamentally, it does have to do with the same attributes of isolation, of equivalence, performance, and safety, right? And it also has to do with the same attributes of actually having this encapsulation property, right? So, you know, Amazon today provides you the ability to have a bare metal VM, but it's exactly the same operating model. And that is because they virtualized the IO subsystem and dedicated a computer to you. So, to me, that is still effectively a form of virtualization, because at the end of the day, the problem that we're trying to solve is this multi-tenancy problem, right? We need to build systems that are multi-tenant. We want to build systems that are multi-tenant. And certainly, you want to have the infrastructure layer, a infrastructure foundation that is intrinsically multi-tenant. VMs happen to be the most efficient way to do it, but it's not the only way, and you can go more finer grain or you can go coarser grain.